Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. How does backyard barbecue without the backyard sound? We'll have more on that and other good things to eat a little bit later with Sauce Magazine's hit list. But first, speaking of hits, the brand new book Eligible by local author Curtis Sittenfeld is just out, but has already cracked the New York Times bestseller list. It's listed at number 5 after a late April release. As you may know, it's her modern retelling of Jane Austen's 200-year-old classic, Pride and Prejudice, the story of the 5 Bennet sisters, their mother's relentless efforts to marry them off, and what all that leads to. Sittenfeld's story revolves around sisters Liz and Jane, just as Ms. Austen's did, but modern Cincinnati and today's Moors are a lot different than Jane Austen's early 19th-century England. Curtis Sittenfeld visited our studio yesterday. Curtis Sittenfeld, it's so nice to have you back with us once again. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, I was thinking earlier that I haven't seen the kind of attention Eligible is getting. I guess since the Harper Lee Comes a Watchman came out. I mean, that was everywhere, but I find you everywhere I turn. You're at all the publications, the newspapers, interviews, radio. NPR has had you on forever, it seems, in connection with this book.
Well, sometimes, actually, if a friend says to me, I saw you in such and such, you know, magazine, I think, oh, okay, well, I know, you know, which publications you can see. Like if someone says, I saw you in O Magazine, then I think, I didn't know you were in O Magazine. Or someone says, I saw you in the New York Times. But my publisher for 13 years has been Random House for my entire career. And my publicists do an excellent job. I think that if I were not me, I would think that my publicist maybe did a disgustingly good job. But since I am me, I just think they do a good job.
The marketing of the book, obviously, is extremely important, but it's difficult work for the author, too, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think that authors probably should never complain too much. I mean, we get to sort of sit at our desks, fiction writers, we get to sit at our desks and make things up. So compared to a lot of other jobs, I would say it's not that challenging.
You know, do you think that you could have pulled this off? That is, taking Pride and Prejudice, the Jane Austen novel. Could you have pulled this off if you weren't already a best-selling author?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by pulled it off. I mean, so this is my 5th book.
Right.
And as you said, it's a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice. It takes place in 2013 in Cincinnati, Ohio. I think that I don't think I would have wanted to, honestly, because I think that I have a thicker skin than I did 5 books ago, mm-hmm. 5 books and 11 years ago. And I think in order to write a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice, you have to have a pretty thick skin. Like, actually, from the beginning, I was approached about doing this project by some British editors who were doing something they called the Austen Project, where they were asking 6 writers to write contemporary versions of each of Austen's 6 novels. And they invited me to do Pride and Prejudice. And the first thing my husband said was, you have to be prepared to be severely, severely criticized. Which he was saying in a sort of protective sense, but he also was kind of right. I mean, there's a lot of love for Jane Austen, and that translates as some people thinking any derivation of her stories I would love to read, any fan fiction, anything that's inspired by Austen I love. And then I think that can also translate into people thinking those novels should not be touched. They're perfect and they should be left alone.
By pulling it off, I guess what I mean is having the confidence to do it. A first author, I mean, as a first book, that would be extremely difficult to pull it off, using my term.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the act of writing wouldn't necessarily be more or less challenging, but I do think, I suppose, the marketing and promotion process. I mean, the thing is, honestly, I'm a pretty neurotic, fretful person, but the things that I worry about are not like somebody saying, that's a terrible book or you shouldn't have written that. Like, it's sort of like, oh, who cares about that? I mean, I think people, in some ways, because there are a lot of serious problems in the world, I think people like to get worked up and agitated about sort of cultural, quote unquote, scandals because they're really kind of insignificant, yeah. Right? Like, if you think, you know, the way that song was performed, like let's have a 20-minute argument about that. It's actually kind of what you're doing is just sort of recreational.
Yeah. How thick is your skin?
Ha! 2 inches? I don't know. That's a really difficult question to answer.
Well, I ask it because there have been some critics of the book.
There have been some critics. Right. One or two. No, three or four.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that, you know, after all the work and the time that you've put in on something like that, taking on what is a considerable challenge, it had to be very challenging to do it. Or was it?
Well, okay. So I'll answer this question sort of one by one. One, I'm one of four siblings, and when I was growing up, like when I was, I guess maybe in my late teens or early 20s, sometimes at Christmas, my family would try to find a movie that we would all go to see, and it was very difficult to find anything that we could even all agree on going to see. And then never was there a time that we went to a movie and we all thought that was great. Like, it was like a success if maybe 2 out of 6 people thought it was good. So I think I've just always known you cannot please everyone. And if you are a novelist, you learn that lesson repeatedly. Like, it's not as if my previous 4 books have met with universal love. Like, I wish they had, but they haven't. So in terms of sort of withstanding criticism, it's not like if I had written something other than a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice, I would not subject myself to any criticism. You can't write a criticism-proof book. And then I guess in terms of the actual experience of you know, sort of getting a negative review, and this book is definitely, you know, it's gotten some very positive reviews. It's gotten a couple high profile. There are 2 that spring to mind, 2 very high profile negative reviews. And there's actually, I think this is a quotation from the British writer Kingsley Amis, that he said something like, "A negative review can spoil my breakfast, but not my lunch." And I always loved that. Like, it's like, of course I'd rather someone, you know, writes me a love letter instead of sort of trashes my book. But it's also like I have to keep it in perspective. You can't please everyone. I have a job that I love. I'm an incredibly lucky person on the whole.
Yeah. I'm looking in front of me here at some of the things that have been said. The New York Times is one of those high profile critiques, if you will, calling it a glib chick lit.
Well, it's actually interesting because even the term chick lit is sort of controversial, or it turns out, as I myself, you know, learned some years back, there's not really a consensus on what that means. Something that I think is actually funny about the reviews is that a few of them have said something along the lines of, "Eligible is really nothing more than a delightful romp." And I'll think, thank you so much. Like, you know, I couldn't be more proud of myself, right? I've achieved everything I wanted to. So it's, I mean, the book actually is meant to be fun. And I'm considered, quote unquote, a literary writer, which, again, that's sort of a publishing term that most readers don't care about. But I think that there are some critics or some readers who find it almost inconceivable that someone who's a literary writer would choose to write something with the primary goal that it's fun.
That is exactly the word that I would use, by the way, having read it, that it was a lot of fun to read. USA Today, by the way, also called it wickedly entertaining. So I want to be sure that we have all of this balanced.
I know. Thank you. A fair, balanced, you know, portrayal of the reviews.
I think that some of the critics tend to be snobbish at times, and I think tampering with Jane Austen probably tempered some of those critics, don't you think? Some of the things they said.
Yeah, well, so it's really interesting because there's a sort of segment of society known as a Janeite, and that's a person who's very devoted to Jane Austen, you know, very familiar with her work, perhaps even on occasion puts on an Empire Waist dress and a bonnet and sort of celebrates. And I think that my publisher and I in advance wondered if the toughest critics would be Janeites. And there are, I think, some sort of Austen purists who think that my telling of the story is a little irreverent. But actually, I think it's turned out that the kind of person who's the most resistant to Eligible, my suspicion is someone who hasn't read Pride and Prejudice for maybe, say, 40 years and thinks they remember it, but actually don't. Like, doesn't remember the content of, like, it's lots of parties and gossip and romance and thinks of it as almost like the Bible. And, like, I mean, Pride and Prejudice is magnificent. I would say it's not the Bible in tone, content, influence. So So, yeah, I mean, but again, Austin can be many things to many people. And I think that eligible can be many things to many people, too. Like, even I think some people who are diehard Austin fans actually like eligible because they can tell that I had Pride and Prejudice open on my lap at times when I was writing. And so there are very close parallels between certain iconic, important scenes, like when Darcy proposes or when Jane gets sick and Liz goes through bad weather to sort of rescue her sister or check up on her sister. So some of the Janeites or other close followers of Austin actually appreciate that level of detail in a way that maybe more casual readers don't.
You know, one of the things, and I reread the original, if you will.
Oh, you're one of the good ones.
Ready.
Yeah, well,
to get ready for you, because I wanted to see how you did it. And one of the things that I rediscovered was what a great sense of humor she had. She was funny.
Oh, Austin is hilarious.
She must have been giggling and many times when she was writing.
I agree completely. She has an excellent sense of humor. Had, I should say. I know it's always confusing because you talk about a book in the present tense, but I guess the author herself in the past tense.
You do too. I mean, you bring a lot of humor into your book.
Thank you, Don.
There was one line, I have a note here. She was describing one character as superlatively stupid. It doesn't get any better than that. If you want to really put somebody down, that's the way to do it. Tell me something about the process. You had the book open on your lap, as you say. And I read somewhere in the many interviews that I've been exposed to recently.
Against your will. No, voluntarily.
That you went through chapter by chapter and picked out highlights that you knew you had to include in your book. What about other parts of the process?
So the way that I started was I wrote an outline. There are 61 chapters in Pride and Prejudice, and I wrote an outline of a few sentences for each chapter so I knew what happened. And originally, I thought that I would, you know, have a one-to-one relationship between Austin's chapters and my chapters in Eligible. And as I progressed, I would change one thing in Eligible, and then I couldn't re-enter Austin's outline, what I had created as a sort of retroactive outline. And so then I made my own outline, and I ended up having close to, I think, 180 chapters, although I do feel a little bit, like, sensitive or defensive about the fact that Eligible has a lower word count than Pride and Prejudice. I felt like it would be sort of disrespectful to write a longer book than Pride and Prejudice, you know, as a retelling. So I did, you know, I ended up deviating a lot from Austin's plot, starting with the fact that, you know, her book takes place in a British village in the early 1800s. Mine takes place in 2013 in Cincinnati, Ohio. But a lot of the sort of major scenes, or what I think to readers are the most memorable scenes, they do have counterparts in Eligible. Partly because, I mean, that's the fun. And also, another thing I did, I kept the characters' names the same, partly so that readers wouldn't have to be distracted thinking, like, who's this and who's this? And so a few characters have slightly altered names, but it's like there's Mr. Bennett and Mrs. Bennett and Fitzwilliam Darcy and Charlotte Lucas. So all our old friends are there.
Yeah, they all are. But one of the big differences is that the girls are older than in the original by almost twice as many years. In the 1940 film Pride and Prejudice, which starred Greer Garson as Liz, the only criticism that I saw was the fact that she was too old for the part.
Oh, that's fun. And how old was she at the time? Do you know?
She was about 37, 38, close to the age
horrors.
Of
Greer.
No. Oh, yeah, isn't that an awful age? My God. But why did you decide to make them older?
So in Pride and Prejudice, the eldest Bennett sisters, Jane is and Liz are both, Lizzie, are both in their early 20s. And it seemed ridiculous to me that even a mother, you know, a middle-aged mother obsessed with marrying off her children would be panicked when they're in their early 20s.
Some things never change, right?
Really? Well, no. But I mean, so I think it's possible still for a parent to feel that panic. I personally don't think it's justified, but I can see a parent feeling it. But I don't think you'd feel it when your daughter's like 21 years old. So the Bennett, Liz and Jane. Jane is about to turn 40, and Liz is 38 and eligible. And there's more of a sense of sort of concern or nosiness about their biological clocks. And in fact, this is not giving away too much because it's in the early chapters, Jane has been looking into having a baby on her own using donor sperm.
Quite different. I wonder what Jane
Austen. You don't remember that part of Pride and Prejudice? The donor sperm chapter? Yeah. Come on.
Well, then you get into another subject that is of more modern usage, and that would be the transgender world, LGBT world.
Yeah, there's a transgender character in Eligible. It's interesting because a few people have said to me, primarily journalists have said this, they've said almost like, you know, the book has all these elements of the zeitgeist in it, and how did you decide which issues you wanted to sort of tackle? And that's actually not the way I think of it. Like, first of all, a novel cannot really capture the zeitgeist, I think, except sort of by accident, partly because a writer turns in a novel and it's not published for a year. And the zeitgeist is a fleeting thing. So I would say there's a transgender character in Eligible, not because they're, you know, being transgender is in the zeitgeist, but because there are transgender people in the world and there always have been. So it's almost like I felt like it worked with the plot and it worked with the character and it seemed organic to me. But it's not a reflection of my trying to capture a trend, just because, I mean, it's like a magazine article is a place for capturing a trend. A novel, I think, is not.
We have to take a break. We'll come back and pick up on these and other points. When we come back, we're talking with Curtis Sittenfeld, and she is the author of the brand new book, Eligible, which is just out a week or so. It's been gaining a lot of publicity, as we have indicated, because it is her version of Pride and Prejudice, written by Jane Austen only a couple of hundred years ago. Curtis Sittenfeld, our guest, will be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Okay, we are back with Curtis Sittenfeld. We're talking about her book, Eligible. I'd like to have you read a little portion of the book, and then we'll talk about why you chose Cincinnati as the place to tell this story.
All right, so this is from the opening lines. Well before his arrival in Cincinnati, everyone knew that Chip Bingley was looking for a wife. 2 years earlier, Chip, graduate of Dartmouth College and Harvard Medical School, scion of the Pennsylvania Bingleys, who in the 20th century had made their fortune in plumbing fixtures, had, ostensibly with some reluctance, appeared on the juggernaut reality television show Eligible. Over the course of 8 weeks in the fall of 2011, 25 single women had lived together in a mansion in Rancho Cucamonga, California, and vied for Chip's heart, accompanying him on dates to play blackjack in Las Vegas and taste wine at vineyards in Napa Valley, fighting with and besmirching one another in and out of his presence. At the end of each episode, every woman received either a kiss on the lips from him, which meant she would continue to compete, or a kiss on the cheek, which meant she had to return home immediately. In the final episode, with only two women remaining, Kara, a wide-eyed, blonde, ringleted, 23-year-old former college cheerleader turned second-grade teacher from Jackson, Mississippi, and Marcy, a duplicitous yet alluring brunette 28-year-old dental hygienist from Morristown, New Jersey, Chip wept profusely and declined to propose marriage to either. They both were extraordinary, he declared, stunning and intelligent and sophisticated, but toward neither did he feel what he termed a soul connection. In compliance with FCC regulations, Marcy's subsequent tirade consisted primarily of bleeped out words that nevertheless did little to conceal her rage.
That is so 21st century.
I know. Yeah, I don't think there would be any confusion over which is Pride and Prejudice and which is eligible.
You know, the funniest line there, the funniest words are Rancho Cucamonga.
Thank you.
That must be a lot of fun to be thinking up the various elements of these personalities of these women. Most people, I would guess, would think when they see the title of the book, Eligible, that you're talking about the eligibility of the sisters. But it's the reality show.
Well, it's sort of all of it, right? It's all of the above. You know, there's a lot of single people kind of mixing it up and eligible. So, right.
What about Dad, Mr. Bennett? He was one of my favorite characters in the original book because he was so understated and cynical and so many other kinds of things. How about dealing with him? You certainly retained a lot of that.
Well, it's funny because in Pride and Prejudice, I think that Mr. Bennett and Lizzie have this sort of special relationship or special understanding where Mrs. Bennett is overbearing and annoying and misunderstands situations and relationships. But Mr. Bennett, who sort of removes himself from the chaos of the household, is much funnier and much more insightful. And actually, the truth is that when I wrote Eligible in the first draft, I accidentally made Mr. Bennett a little bit meaner. And it was my husband who pointed out to me, that's such a like lovely relationship in Pride and Prejudice. And there's not really any reason for you to alter it for the worse. And I thought about it and I thought, you're right, actually. So.
How much of a role does your husband have in your writing?
He reads an early complete draft. I'm not one of those people who says to my husband or to anyone else, like, listen to this paragraph I read today, because I just don't think, I think out of context, it's very hard to evaluate an incomplete piece of writing. So I do listen to my husband. Something my husband said recently. So Eligible is a bestseller, which is, you know, very exciting. And he said to me recently, you're like Beethoven, where every other thing that you write is successful. Like basically my first, my third, and my fifth novels have sort of, and then, yeah. So he has a kind of, I don't know, sort of wry, encouraging view of my career. He's not a fiction writer himself, which I think is probably for the best.
Mm-hmm. I heard you on the Diane Rehm show the other day. you know what's coming now. And she kind of came out of left field talking about she had learned that you and your husband met speed dating. which makes me wonder why speed dating wasn't a part of your book.
I know it should have been. You know, I feel like speed dating was kind of this passing trend of maybe 10 years ago, and I'm not sure I don't know if it's still, partly I don't know because I'm not single, because I was such a successful speed. No, I'm just kidding. I was not that successful. You only need to be successful with one person. But yeah, I'm just really proud of myself that I've become like the go-to NPR speed dating expert. That's really gratifying in my career. Any questions you have, any questions your listeners have, I'd be happy to.
Well, why don't you explain what speed dating is for those who missed the boat on that.
I know. So again, I feel like this was trendy in maybe 2004, 2003. I think it actually originated, maybe a rabbi in L.A. Dreamed it up. But basically, the sort of heterosexual version of this would be there would be 25 men and 25 women. And let's say all the women are sitting in one place and they all talk to each other. Each woman has one man across from her. And the couple talk, then, you know, the possible couple, maybe future couple, talks to each other for like 3 minutes. A whistle blows. All the men stand up. They all move to a chair, one to their right. And then so basically within, say, an hour, all the men and all the women have talked to each other. And then you kind of can mark on a piece of paper and say, I would see you again, or I would never see you, you know, even when hell freezes over, I would see you again. I was writing an article for the Washington Post about speed dating, and so it kind of gave me some plausible deniability where people would say to me, well, you were only speed dating for that article, but the truth was I was only writing that article so that I could speed date, and I got so lucky.
That's a good cover. Good.
I know, yeah, exactly. Cover. Yeah, under the cover of journalism. Maybe you know something about that. You can delve into all kinds of topics.
It's a great excuse for doing things you otherwise would never.
Yeah, why do you think I've worked as a journalist?
You said it might have been invented by a rabbi in 2003
or 2004. I think maybe, yeah.
What's
yeah.
next, a speed bris?
I know. Well, that, who knows?
Yeah. Let me come back to eligible because...
Why?
This is so much
I know,
fun.
We could think about my other adventures from being a single woman, 12 years ago.
Seems like such a long time ago, doesn't it? Why Cincinnati? I know you grew up in Cincinnati, but why Cincinnati for the locale?
Well, first, I will say that I think I've always thought since I moved to St. Louis almost 9 years ago that St. Louis and Cincinnati are extremely similar, in terms of being these medium-sized Midwestern cities. And I mean, that's just the beginning of what in both places you get asked where you went to high school. But I think to me, if you Pride and Prejudice obviously is set in a small English village in the early 1800s and Eligible is set in Cincinnati in 2013. And I think that if you an outsider would think, what could happen that's very interesting in either of those places? Like, it's not London, it's not New York, it's not the coasts. But in fact, I think that people lead interesting lives or lives that are interesting to them no matter where they live. And so, there's always drama and intrigue and people who annoy you and people that you have crushes on. And it was more interesting to me, and it may be more challenging to me in a fun way, to prove that Cincinnati is a juicy location than to sort of choose an inherently juicy location like, San Francisco or New York, something that everyone agrees is interesting and sexy.
Of course, you're living in St. Louis now. I think a lot of people would be happy that you didn't choose St. Louis as the locale.
Why?
Because there were a lot of unflattering things said about Cincinnati.
Do you think so? Really? It's interesting, actually, because a few people have said, I feel like Eligible is a love letter to Cincinnati. What did you think was unflattering?
Well, how did you start the book?
I have no idea what you're talking about. So there is, there's this... Yeah, it starts with a quotation from Mark Twain that actually there's not 100% certainty that Mark Twain said it, but it was so irresistible that I thought, and it's a novel, so who cares? But when the end of the world comes, I want to be in Cincinnati because it's always 20 years behind the times. I just thought I thought it was so fitting. How could I help myself? I will say in the book, my Darcy and my Bingley are both doctors. Darcy is a neurosurgeon. Bingley is an ER doctor. They're both from outside Cincinnati, and they're not exactly thrilled that they live in Cincinnati. Meanwhile, Liz and Jane have been living in New York and have returned to Cincinnati because their father has had a health scare. So there's this sort of insider-outsider tension of, snobbishness toward Midwestern cities. But then there's also that snobbishness that natives of a city can feel after leaving it, either without returning or after returning. They can think like, ugh, like I grew up here, but, I'm not the biggest fan. And I think that Liz Bennett herself, in my version, has conflicted feelings about the Midwest.
And Darcy had a number of put-downs along the way. That's kind of what I was thinking of, and that supposed Mark Twain.
Yes. Okay, fair enough. I can see that not everything is a love letter to Cincinnati and Eligible.
There's a lot more sex in your story than in Jane Austen's. Surprise.
I know. I feel like you just sold me about 1,000 books. Go on.
No, you go on. You're the author.
Well, okay,
you have something in there called hate sex, which I thought was a different way of putting it.
Well, so here's the thing. First of all, I certainly did not come up with the term hate sex. I'm just an observer of our society.
It's probably Mark Twain that came up with that.
So here's the thing. As we discussed earlier, my Liz and Jane Bennett are close to 40 years old. they both, you know, spoiler alert, they both end up in very serious romances. You might even say on the cusp of marriage by the end of the book. I think that in the you know, age we live in now, I wouldn't say it's unprecedented, but I would say it's very unusual that if two people in their late 30s get to the point of engagement, that they have kept it chaste. Usually I think there is some physical involvement. And I think that in general, I'm a very detailed writer. And so it's like if the character is eating a meal, I tell you what it is. Or if the character is going for a run, you know, I describe the sweat. And I feel like, I guess that sometimes readers end up being surprised that if I'm describing sex, I pull back a little bit, but I don't pull back that far. Like, I feel like it remains consistently detailed, which, here's the truth. I mean, there are people who think like I've had people, of course, say to me, Jane Austen is rolling over in her grave, which the thing that I think is like, how do you know? But at the same time, I mean, it would be ridiculous to pretend that. I think the great majority of readers are just fine reading a book with a bit of sex in it. I do not think that's a deterrent to most people.
Is it difficult to write? I mean, you know that other people are going to be reading it when you're writing a sex scene, for instance. Is that tough for an author, for this author?
Well, I think the whole process of writing a novel is very interior, and you have to kind of tune out all these distractions, including like what will people think when they read this 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. So the act of writing, I mean, I really, and sometimes I do get distracted, but I really try to focus and think what is in the service of the scene that I'm writing right now? Like what dialogue works? How would this character move or feel, or what would they think? I'm not just talking about sex, by the way. I'm talking about everything, every scene. And so you can't, I mean, it's almost like if you were getting dressed in the morning and you thought, like, what is so-and-so going to think about my outfit? Like, you can sort of think that fleetingly, but you can't live your life sort of thinking about how you're going to be received by other people. And you have to have faith in your own kind of, I mean, if I'm a writer, which I am, I have to have faith in my own ability to tell a story, and I have to trust my instincts. And the thing that's nice about being a fiction writer and having many years to work on a book is that I can write something and then say it turns out terribly, I can just, you know, put it in the recycling bin and no one has to know except for me. So it's like there is time to change stuff. It's not, I'm not like live writing something and posting it and sending it out into the world. But all that said, I will admit, I read my books aloud to myself before publication, especially as it gets closer and closer to the final draft. Like, I want to, you know, see if there's like words that sound, you know, sort of awkward or whatever. So occasionally I will be reading a sex scene out loud in my own house. And if I have young children, if my children are there, and if a babysitter is like a few rooms away with my children, I'll think like, I will have this self-consciousness that I perhaps didn't have before. And then I will feel almost like, oh God, like what have I done? Or was this all a bad idea? But usually by that point, it's too late. You know, I can change little things, but I can't change entire chapters.
Do you blush at your own stuff?
Occasionally, only if it's very, very racy. You know, honestly, I Eligible is not as racy as some of my other books are. It's a little less detailed. My mother said to me when I was, you know, had taken on this project of a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice, she said, Curtis, the reason that people like Jane Austen is that she's subtle. And I said, yeah, I know. And my mother said, no, subtle. She's subtle. And I was like, I understand exactly what you're saying. So I tried to sort of keep that in mind to some extent. Although, again, you know, it would be preposterous to think that like I don't think most readers would wish for a chaste Darcy and Liz in a 2016 version of Pride and Prejudice.
How do you think Jane Austen would feel about your version?
I think that I have probably been presumptuous enough just in the act of writing this, and I don't need to try to guess at her reaction. But I will say, as a writer myself, if you said to me 200 years from now, you know, people will be essentially writing fan fiction or your books will be so alive to people and so much a part of the culture, I would be thrilled.
Really? Well, I think she'd love it. I think she would love it. One other area I would like to get to, if you don't mind talking about this, and that is, you know, you have some high degree of celebrity with every book that you write. It increases. How does that work at home? I'm serious. I mean, I think you're busy. You're on the road a lot to promoting this book. You're writing. You say it's a very interior thing. You're probably off in a room by yourself most of the time. But you are married and you have kids. How does that work, being a writer and managing the other part of your life?
Well, I think it works the way it works for any, you know, working parent, where, you know, lots of people are like doctors and have kids, or teachers and have kids. And to be a writer and have kids is not that different from other professions. I mean, in some ways, it's probably easier because I have more flexibility. I work from home. I set my own schedule. So I'm lucky in that way. But, I mean, my children and my husband, of course, know that I'm a writer. I would say they do not think of me primarily as a writer. I mean, I think my husband thinks of me as, like, Curtis, who forgets to buy, like, paper towels at the grocery store. You know, it's like my day-to-day life is a pretty ordinary suburban life, which is not a bad thing. I mean, that's in most ways it's a nice thing. But and I'm not on the road that much. So I have a book come out, it seems like, maybe every 3 years. And when that happens, I promote it for a few weeks. But, like, I mean, I could probably for a year or two do nothing. I could, like, watch TV all day in yoga pants and no one would know. Mm-hmm. It's not as if I'm, like, on, you know, Good Morning America every day or something like that. It's not a high-profile life on the whole.
Well, it certainly seems to on Good Morning America every day or something like that.
No, zero times have I. No, I mean, I'm glad you have that illusion, but it's actually not true.
Yeah. Well, we wish you the greatest success with this. It's a wonderful read. I enjoyed it, for whatever that's worth, for people who are listening right now. It's a lot of fun, as we indicated before. Is there going to be a movie version?
There has been some interest, although nothing, you know, no contracts have been signed, but you never know. No, by the way, I will say my life is my schedule is flexible enough in my life. I don't know if this is a sign of how glamorous or not glamorous my life is, but I very frequently listen to St. Louis on the Air in my kitchen, in my house, in suburban St. Louis. So it's I don't know if that's part of the like my jet setting, you know, lifestyle that you're imagining. But,
well, we have been called highly inspirational. I don't know by whom, but I'm gonna. That's
by
my
me,
story.
By me.
That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Are you working on anything now?
Sort of. I have written 2 pages of another novel, which was about one honest day's work. But I look forward to buckling down after I finish sort of my eligible promotion.
Well, as they say, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, right? So 2 pages is a pretty good start by most standards. That's Curtis, true. Thank you so much for being with us. And again, we wish you the greatest success with Eligible.
Thank you so much for having me, Don.
Local author Curtis Sittenfeld talking about her book, Eligible, and some other things. It's a hit. And our next segment focuses on a hit list, courtesy Sauce Magazine. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.